That's a lot better for them. So we're going to leave that until 12:30. Then I think we should still put the transformers across.
Yep.
Okay, because then everyone's in the same circle,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So they're happy with that time being. All right, it's a great reduction. All right. I'll grab that lapel.
Hey. Hey.
Hey, hey. Hey, hey.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you could take your seats, please. Please take your seats. Ladies and gentlemen, we're starting.
Been there, done that.
Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. We're going to start again. Okay, thanks everybody. Our next session is an update on IANA, and that's going to be given to us by, as always, by Kim. So, Kim.
Thank you, Chris. I couldn't help but notice that Paul suggested everyone get in a taxi and go down to Sydney Harbour because it was such a nice day. And I see that about half of you have. So for everyone else that's remained, thank you very much. Welcome to my home country. Perhaps not my home city, but I hope the hospitality is very nice anyway. I'm going to touch firstly on a subject that I mentioned at the Mexico City meeting, technical conformance. Since that meeting, we've moved forward and more or less completed this particular project. What this involved is to bring the minimum technical criteria for root zone changes up to date. And what that means is that over the course of managing the root zone, we've sort of evolved these processes to better reflect implementing some basic principles. And those basic principles are that name servers should be correctly configured and meet a certain level of minimum technical standards before any changes are permitted in the root zone. The documentation that we had on the website was quite out of date. There were some documents, they weren't complete, but they were authored around 2001-2002. This project here was to put the complete, accurate, up-to-date list of technical checks on our website available for everyone to look at. As part of that, we also phased in three additional checks. One is a prohibition on open recursive name servers. Secondly, a different and more appropriate diversity requirement. And thirdly, a prohibition on fragmentation of root zone referrals. And I'll just briefly explain a little about what each of those is about. Firstly, open recursive name servers. These are not required to run a TLD. In fact, they introduce some bad properties that are generally not desirable when you're operating a TLD. For example, they're open to cache poisoning attacks like the Kaminsky attack. And they're also open for amplification attacks. So there's no reason you would need an open recursive name server, so we've added a prohibition on that. And I just wanted to add the caveat, as I think you're all aware, is with these technical checks, if you fail any of them, it doesn't necessarily prohibit your change being enacted. What that will do is trigger a dialogue between the TLD operator and ourselves. We'll discuss what the issue is, work out whether it's a problem for the root zone, whether you're aware of what the issue is. If for some reason the configuration you have triggers a fault, but you're aware of what the fault is and it doesn't really concern you and you're satisfied that internet stability is not harmed, we're happy to proceed with the change regardless. So that's open recursive name servers. The second one is network diversity. The informal rule that we used up until recently was you can't have all your name servers in the same, what we call /24 network. That was relevant perhaps in the 1980s to determine whether two servers were in the same network, but it's certainly not true today. What happens today is that every IP address is advertised in a global routing table. And our new test suggests that we inspect that routing table and make sure that the IP addresses you use for your name servers come through at least two different networks. I showed this graph last meeting, but the projection was so bad no one could actually see it, so I just thought I'd quickly repeat it. This is a graph of CCTLDs and which ones meet the diversity requirement that we have implemented. As you can see, the red countries are those that don't have minimum diversity. The yellow countries are the ones that have diversity but just two diverse networks, and the green ones have three or more. So as you can see, as a test, it actually won't affect many, and I think those that are implicated actually warrant a discussion. And the third thing is that referrals should not fragment. And what this means is that when the root servers return responses for looking up domains, they return a list of name servers for TLDs. When this list is returned, we want to make sure that the list is small enough that the name server does not need to send a lot more traffic than it needs to. There's a classical limit in the DNS of 512 bytes. If all your name servers fit in the space of 512 bytes, then the root servers only need to send one packet in response to a query. If it's more than 512 bytes, possibly the name servers then need to send, I think it was like 10 or 11 packets back and forth. So it's actually an order of magnitude more expensive for a root server to process requests if you're not within that limit. I went into this actually more detail at the last meeting, and I'm not going to repeat the details of this, but the slides are there with the formulas involved if you're interested in that. So the bottom line of these three checks is that 9.6% of TLDs have open recursive name servers, so over 90% are in compliance. 7.2% don't have diverse connectivity, so over 90% are compliant. And 4.3% have referrals that can fragment, so over 95% there are compliant. So as a result, we introduced those new tests after extensive consultation with the community. We did a public comment period. I've spoken at these meetings, I've spoken at centre meetings, I've spoken at technical meetings. This document has been like 3 years in the making. But at this stage, no one seems to object to any of the checks, and everyone thinks they're quite reasonable. So about 2 weeks ago, we published them formally. They're available on our website, and they're available to read now. I expect that we won't come into this situation again with IANA where our practices diverge from what we've got in writing. I would thoroughly hope that should we need to amend any of these practices, we update the documentation first and then we make the change. Hopefully that's a historical anomaly that won't repeat itself. Next steps, well, those checks are already implemented in the root zone management automation software, which I'll come to in more detail in a minute. We've also almost finished an online web tool to check for conformance. The automation software will check for conformance anyway, but that's part of actually submitting a request to change your name servers. What this tool will allow you to do is to check at any time whether your current name servers are in conformance, and also if you're thinking of changing your configuration, you can check whether the new configuration is in conformance. That online web tool is a separate implementation from the RZM, so what's happened is one of our staff members has developed the automation software along with NASC, the Polish registry. The web tool itself, actually, I've developed, and we've actually compared our implementations to try and pick any bugs in either one. And as a result of developing this tool, we've actually created a library of DNS sort of abstraction tests that we will, I hope, publish as a sort of software library that others can reuse. The third thing we'll probably do is once we have root zone automation in place, we'll start sending quarterly audit emails. So we'll notify all TLD operators how they comply with these tests. So that you're aware that if any of your name servers don't meet these tests, you'll have a heads up email. And you can evaluate whether you want to make a change or not based on that. We don't police this. This is just an informative email to you. So the next project I wanted to talk about, something I've been working on quite a lot these last couple of months, is really documenting all of IANA's processes. I don't know, how many of you were around at ICANN meetings in 2002, just out of curiosity? So I'd say that's maybe 20%. So this is kind of new to a lot of you, but this was around the time I started coming to ICANN meetings as well myself. And at that time, there was a fierce hostility between CCTLDs and IANA, and it all centered around a document called ICP1. What ICP1 was an attempt by ICANN to update its procedure document, so-called RFC 1591. IANA originally published RFC 1591 in 1994, describing its procedures at the time. ICP1 was published in 1999, updating some of those procedures. And because of the way it was deployed, it wasn't well received. And I'm sure someone can write a book about the particular history of that. But suffice it to say, it was controversial. But I think that in the time since then, really a lot has changed, and I don't think ICANN should be as hesitant anymore to attempt to publish its procedures, so long as there's community consultation, everyone's involved in the editing process, and we have collaboration in developing what those are. So right now I'm in the process of documenting all of our procedures so that you can review them. In particular, documenting the procedures we use for redelegation processing. I believe that will be very useful input for the new CCNSO redelegation working group. I'm also developing some analyses on the current processes. As staff, we have views on what works and what doesn't. A lot of the stuff we've inherited and we've been sort of loath to change because it's what people are used to, but at the same time, we believe some of it can be improved, and I think the analysis will help you decide whether our policies should change. Just an idea of some of the analysis that we're doing. I've actually gone through line by line, phrase by phrase, through RFC 1591 and ICP1 and done a complete analysis of everything that's in there, working out which is still valid, which is not valid, what parts are in the first document, which are in the second. And I think that, as well as other bits and pieces, will help inform our future dialogue on how that kind of stuff should be documented in future. So the next topic I wanted to talk about is root zone workflow automation, or as it's known in centre community, EIANA. The root zone automation software is something I've been working on since I started at ICANN in 2005. The idea is to automate a number of aspects of how we manage the root, so there's less manual processing where it's not needed. We developed a software package in conjunction with the community. It was more or less feature complete, maybe 18 months ago, if not almost 2 years ago. Last year, we had discussions with NTIA, our IANA contract manager, on how we can deploy the software. Initially, we had a certain approach agreed, and we were working on that approach. In mid-2008, the staff at NTIA changed. We were advised to take a different approach to how we deploy it. As a result of that new approach, we submitted a test plan in October 2008. Over the following months, they came back with some questions, and we responded to the questions. But I'm pleased to say around 2 or 3 weeks ago, this month, NTIA authorized that we proceed with testing of the system. And by testing here, I'm not talking about sort of informal offline testing, which we already did in conjunction with the community. Rather, this is actually parallel sort of online operations. So from when we start testing, every request that comes in will go through this new system. We'll also continue manual processing at the same time. And the idea is that as we process manually and as we process automatically every day, we'll monitor the results of both processes, make sure that they're coming out with the same results. And once we've done this for a few months, according to a test plan, probably about 6 months, we'll gain a level of confidence that the system works as expected. And then hopefully we can fully turn on the automated system and stop our manual processing altogether. So that's kind of what we're looking at. Right now we're in the process of just finalizing the test plan with NTIA for public publication. So that test plan shall be shared with the community very soon. Citing the root zone. Well, there's a whole workshop on this later in the week, so I won't go into too much detail, but I think it's common knowledge that people would like the root zone signed. ICANN developed a proposal to sign the root zone. We submitted it to the US government. Similarly, VeriSign submitted a different proposal and submitted it shortly after ours. The US government then issued a notice of inquiry. This notice of inquiry was to obtain views on how root zone signing should happen. That was open until November 24th. The outcome of that review is that the media at the time said that the... the media at the time said that internet experts are siding overwhelmingly with ICANN. I think that was my personal view of the comments, is that they seem to support ICANN signing the root zone. NTIA came back to us recently and instructed us to follow a model where VeriSign is the root zone signer. As we accept that it's important to get DNSSEC implemented in the root zone as soon as possible, we've accepted this and we'll proceed accordingly. There is a role for ICANN there as managing the process of managing the KSK. But like I said, I don't want to go into too much detail. There'll be a whole workshop on that. So please go to that on Wednesday, and NTIA will be there to present as well.
Can we just to stop you there? What time is that on Wednesday? Do you know?
Not off the top of my head. syd.icann.org.
Yeah. It's in the afternoon or the morning? 9 o'clock. Okay, thanks.
So perhaps not useful for conflicting with your agenda.
That's why I asked. We'll sort that out.
Okay. So just finally, I wanted to touch on some other IANA activities of interest to you. Firstly, our management, particularly Paul Toomey, is very interested in quality service delivery in the organisation. And as I guess the most operational part, and I would like to think the department within ICANN that has its act most together, we're being used as the prototype for deploying quality management services within the company. We're doing that based on a model called EFQM, which I don't know a lot about, but I'm sure I will soon. The first evaluation of IANA against this quality management model is proposed for May of next year. The aim is to document, capture, and study all the different resources required to perform IANA functions as best we can. We intend to compare how ICANN performs these functions against other similar organizations so we can get a handle on how we can improve service and to adopt objectives and manage performance in order to achieve an excellent service as possible. The Trust Anchor repository is still running. No known defects of any note. There was a few minor issues in the first few weeks that were quickly ironed out, but as I understand it, it's working as expected. One thing I just wanted to note, and I guess this will be a challenge when we automate some of the root zone functions, is that the Trust Anchor repository is almost fully automated. In fact, the submission of changes is automated. Confirmation from contacts is automated. Almost every element of it is automated. And yet, I'd say probably half of TLDs are emailing their Trust Anchors to me. When they get emails to confirm changes, they get an email that says, please confirm by clicking on this link. And then they reply and forward the email to me saying, I agree. So I don't know. I guess everyone's just so used to IANA being so manual that as we introduce some of the automated systems, it's just a bit to grasp for people. So I don't know. I'm sure that will go away soon, but I just thought it was kind of interesting that once we provide the benefits of automation, not everyone's keen to grasp at it. Just finally, a new Whois server. We have a Whois server, whois.iana.org. Right now, you can look up TLD operators. You can look up .int domains, .arpa domains, and also IANA registrar domains. What that means is that IANA is actually an ICANN-accredited registrar, so to speak, and we don't sell domains, obviously, but what we do is we store a lot of the reserved domain names in the IANA registrar. So, for example, a.com is not available for registration. It's reserved under ICANN policy, and that's stored in the IANA registrar. So our Whois server contains the authoritative information for that. But what we're doing is we're replacing the server, something that will scale a little better. We'll use semi-standard RPSL notation for the output. But most importantly, the reason we're doing this is twofold. One is that we can suck in the data from our new root zone automation software rather than our old ICANN reg software. And also because we're taking more responsibility for how we run reverse delegations in .arpa, it will also provide IP address information as well, which it doesn't do today. So the root zone stuff's only a part of that Whois project, but it's certainly something that will be touched by it. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim. Questions? I have Andre, I have a question. While the microphone's going around, I have a question. My understanding is I'm on route signing the route zone. My understanding is that... I'll start again. Say Australia wants to implement DNSSEC, but Australia does not want VeriSign signing .au. My understanding is that we can still implement DNSSEC, and there are alternatives to actually having the .au signed by VeriSign. Is that correct?
Right now, as our policy stands, if you have DNS key in your zone, you don't have to submit it to IANA.
Excellent.
And so that's with the ITAR now, and I assume that will be the case with the Root Zone Registry once DNSSEC is fully implemented.
Okay, thank you. Andre.
Andre Philippe.cz. I just wanted to ask, don't you have any statistical data or some feeling how the ITAR is used now?
I don't, but I should have put that together, and I was actually thinking that about 5 minutes before I started. Wouldn't it be great to have some stats? I will compile some and share it perhaps on the mailing list.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, it was declared that ITAR will be closed in the same time as the route is signed. Do you have some precise plan on that? Or
we don't have a precise plan. What we've said is that once the route zone is signed, we'll decommission the ITAR with some reasonable overlap period. To my mind, I was thinking 3 to 6 months, but we would make it clear at the time you've got X amount of time to go. I've heard whisperings in the ICANN community that, and I think Chris touched on this with his question, is that for political reasons, some might want to wish the ITAR to be more of a permanent fixture. It's not something we ever envisaged, but I think that if there is an opinion that it should continue, then it's always up for discussion, and if there's some kind of community consensus, we could keep it running. But right now, our idea is that it would be decommissioned after X months after we sign the route.
Come on down. This one is not working. That one. Okay. Thanks. Can I just say, Gabby will be sending out today, tomorrow, the second version of our DNSSEC survey. The council agreed in Mexico to send that survey out again. It has got additional questions in it. It has additional questions in it that specifically go to the model which the NTIA seems to have imposed. And it also has some questions on the ITAR, which will help presumably to answer some of the statistical questions and also the political questions about it carrying on. So can I encourage everybody, please, to respond to the DNSSEC survey? It's important that our position on various matters is clear and heard. We may not have a clear position, but at least we'll know where we all stand. Thank you. Anything else for? Sorry, Nigel had a question for Kim.
Well, is that on there?
Yeah. You realise that where you're sitting, you won't be able to be seen on the publicly. So
that
was your intention.
That might be seen to be an advantage to some. I was very interested at the technical review of name servers in the route, and you're going to send out from time to time a informative email. If I was to request to you that you look at our configuration and send us up an email beating us up about any problems that you see, would you be able to do that? It would help us.
Is that a question that you would like the tone to be harsher?
Yes, it is, actually. Yeah, no, it is.
Okay.
We have one of our grace and favour secondaries, and we're trying to persuade them to stop doing some things that we think they shouldn't be doing. So.
Okay. Taken under advisement.
I'll speak to you.
I think that's the first time I've ever heard you, Nigel, suggest that ICANN should be harsher.
The other thing is just a commercial plug for one of our registrants. I notice you're using tr.im in your slides, and they're great competitors of ours. There's also a service at ta.gg that you might want to use.
Thank you for that. thank you for that. A word from our sponsor. Any other questions for Kim before we move on? Dottie.
DottieSparks.bi. Anyway, Can you characterize the NTIA staff? Is it technical geeks that are giving you directives, or is it philosophical prophecy kind of people that are giving directives for you to change things and do things a different way?
Yeah, if you... okay, who's got the noose? And
can I leave the stage right now?
No, you can't. You're staying where you are.
I would just say that NTIA consults widely within the US government, and the US government has technical expertise. So
really?
It might not be...
I noticed they were orange in your map, which means that they don't have enough name servers.
I'm not going to comment on who runs .us.
I think that's about the best answer you're going to get on the microphone, Dottie. You can talk to Kim afterwards. Anyone else for Kim before we move on? Okay, thank you very much, Kim.
Thank you.
How do we switch?
I'm on number four over there.
Can we get number four? Ah, look at that. Magnificent. So our next session is a brief session on domain name front running. We're going to have a presentation from Dave Piscitello, and then we're actually going to have like an open microphone. What we want is we want to know from you if you have experienced domain name front running in your ccTLD. So if you have experienced domain name front running in your ccTLD and you're prepared to tell us that, when we get to that section, it would be fantastic if you could just raise your hand and we'll give you the microphone and you can briefly talk about your experiences. But before that, Dave.
Hi, thank you very much for having me here today. And I'm Dave Piscitello. I'm the senior security technologist at ICANN. I spend most of my time with the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, but I'm also now working with Greg Rattray in the ICANN security staff on some global security, stability, and resiliency issues. So I thought I'd introduce the topic by giving a definition of what front-running is. Front-running actually comes from the stock and commodities markets. And the scenario that is described as front-running is rather simple. A client calls up his broker and asks to trade a security. So I call up my broker and I say, I want to sell 150,000 shares of Microsoft. Now, I wish I could sell 150,000 shares of Microsoft, but the broker then says, why is Dave trying to sell 100,000 shares of Microsoft? And considers the possibility that I know something that, you know, that is causing me to do this. And so what he does is he calls his other preferred clients and he says, I think you should sell Microsoft. Or if he has Microsoft in his own portfolio, he says, I think I'm going to sell my Microsoft. In the commodities world, this is an illegal activity because the trade may influence the price of the security. If suddenly hundreds of thousands of shares of Microsoft are being sold, irrespective of what the current market price is, it could drop further, as an example. How does this relate to the domain name world? Domain name front running is a rather similar activity, at least the definition of it is. In this case, an internet user uses some method to check the availability of a label in a TLD. So he's looking for example.uk or example.co.uk. Some third party is monitoring availability checks. Either a whois or some sort of DNS query that would result in a non-existent domain if the domain were available. And by looking at a set of availability checks, he may determine that there is some interest or value ascribed to a particular label. And then the third party preemptively registers that domain name for some purpose, either profit to perhaps sell to the party who is actually looking for it, or because he may see that there's a pay-per-click opportunity or some other means of monetizing the domain. The question naturally arises, who are these third parties that are doing these monitoring activities and performing availability checks? And it turns out that this is the most difficult part of the domain name front-running puzzle to track. Client software, little Windows applications or Mac applications that embed Whois, can monitor availability checks through a back channel. So the software is free, but one of the consequences of using this software is that the developer of the software actually monitors what you do and he collects data from you. It's a lot like spyware. Third-party Whois query portals. Anyone who's running a Whois server, which is relatively simple through a web interface, could be monitoring any activity that you engage in while you're submitting information through his portal. Spyware can. DNS operators could do this by simply looking at their logs and collecting non-existent domain responses. There are claims by individuals who feel they had their names front-run, if that's a verb. Registrars, registries, resellers, clearly the finger pointing just grows and grows and grows as people get frustrated that they had spent a significant amount of time and carefully considered a label only to have it gone moments after they did a query. The most important thing I can say here, and unfortunately most of you probably can't see the last bullet, is that when ESSAC studied this, there were numerous claims, and there's a great deal of speculation, but no smoking guns. We did not have compelling, irrefutable evidence of domain name front-running. One of the things that we did when we were studying this was we tried to reach out and find out from the community, how they felt about it. And one purpose for me to be here today is to actually solicit opinions from the CCTLD community. So some people feel that there's a coincidence, and there's actually a study from Nominet that that suggests in its conclusions that this is, in fact, just simply numerical, numerically proven to be a coincidence and based on probability. Some people feel that it's bad timing. In fact, when I was doing my study of domain name front running, one of the things that I noticed in the behavior or the timelines between the initial query of an individual for a domain of interest and the subsequent time when they went to actually register the domain was that sometimes they took weeks before they went back, and they still felt that that the domain should have been available. Many people feel that even if we can't prove it, we should make a statement, as I can, that this is unacceptable conduct and that it's not different from front-running as you see in stock and commodities. Other people feel that it's acceptable conduct. This is just leveraging a data collection or some other farming or warehousing mechanism for yet another way to profit from the domain name world. What's being done about this? Most of what has been done over a year ago now. ESSAC did a study. The study is published in SAC 25, which you can get on the website. Our study was inconclusive. We actually solicited the community to send us their complaints instead of sending the complaints to the UDRP or submitting them to ICANN compliance so that we could study them ourselves. We followed up using all the available tools that we could to try to gather information. And unfortunately, in most of these cases, people did not collect enough information to even pursue the claim. Nominet did a study, Jay Daly. Is Jay here? Jay's study was, I think, very, very well done. His study said that that domain name front running does not exist. And what I still believe is the case, that this is a very difficult incident. It's a very difficult act to actually find and document examples for. It's very hard to prove that somebody has actually engaged in this activity. Whether I feel that way and whether Jay feels this way, there are still dozens and dozens of people, if not more, who constantly complain to ESSAC that front-running exists. You haven't done enough to demonstrate that it has. You haven't put in a significant effort. So the persistent belief is something that we are still dealing with. That's the sum and total of what I want to do before we have an open discussion. So thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. So, would anybody like to start the ball rolling by saying whether they have or haven't experienced front running in their CCTLD, if they've done any investigation about it, or are we all just don't think it exists? Okay. I will start the ball rolling by saying that I actually think it probably does. In very, very specific circumstances, I can't prove it in .au, but I think it may happen. And it happens, I suspect. This is not intended to be in any way suggesting registrars are a problem, but registrars do have information, and they do have access to data, and they have staff, and the staff have that information and access to data. My indications are that it may happen, but I don't think it happens very often. It happens very often. Stephen.
Two quick questions for you, Chris. One, do you guys get complaints periodically about it? And two, do you have language in your registrar agreements that covers this kind of activity?
We do. Yes, we do get complaints, but not often. And whilst there's nothing specific in... Is there something specific? Apparently, my lawyer tells me, there is actually something specific in our registrar agreement that would prohibit that. And that would also prohibit resellers from... Look, the complaints that we have... a number of complaints that we have looked at and said, clearly this is not the problem, clearly this was coincidence, or clearly, you know, it was 3 weeks, et cetera.
There's one point I'd like to make, and it's sort of, you know, amusing for me to have been, you know, talking with registrars and hear their perspective, and talking with registries and hear their perspective. One of the specific claims made by a registrar was that when they offer the opportunity for someone to register a label that's already taken in COM. So, for example, I go and I look for corecom.com, which I happen to hold. If that label is taken in COM, what many of the registrars do is they actually reach out and do a query to all the TLDs with whom they have a registrar relationship to see if that name is available in any of the other TLDs. So if you type in corecom.com at a registrar, you may get back, corecom.com is taken, but you can try corecom.tv or corecom.au or co.au, however it's organized. And the registrar that, you know, that approached us said that their belief and they, you know, is that the TLD operators are actually the ones who are grabbing these names. And this is one of the reasons why I love the wonderful camaraderie we have in this community, where the fingers just go flying in each direction, yeah, as quickly as possible. So the reason I bring it up here is because it has been, you know, it has been tossed in the form of a gauntlet at you, and yeah, not that SSAC is, you know, feels that's, you know, that has any substance at all, but it's one of those situations like on Law and Order where the police officer says, "Well, I got to ask; it's my job." You know?
Hilda.
Thank you, Hilda Thunem from the Norwegian Registry. As for whether it exists or not, I think the registries have the opportunity to do it, and the registrars have the opportunity to do it, because clearly when a application comes into a registry, we could have sort of the information that someone is already applying and sneaking an application beforehand. It would be possible. So where there is an opportunity, there would probably be some people somewhere doing it, just like front running occasionally does happen in other areas. But in Norway, we haven't seen it as a large problem at all. I think part of it is that it's difficult to do the kind of front running and collect a lot of attractive domain names as an operator, whether you're the registry or the registrar, when you're limited to a total number of 20 domain names for your organization, and that's right. The limit you can have. So running around and kidnapping your customers or prospective customers' domain names aren't that easy. We have seen some not monitoring searches, but looking at the trademark register and the organization register and seeing that, oh, there's a new organization having been registered, so I'll try to think that they probably want a domain name that has something to do with their mm-hmm. organization name and registering it. But calling that front running is, and saying that it has anything to do with the DNS as such is a bit, I mean, it's public information you find right. in the public database, and then you try to use it in a manner that's not necessarily beneficial. But then the ADRP, in our case, will kick in, and you might lose the domain name. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really pass the registry or registrar system as such.
Did you want to say something? No, you're not.
He's actually co-presenting.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm so sorry. Just in time to be late. Do we have any other comments or Rolf? Oh, hang on. Someone's going down the back there. Gabby? Who do we have? Fired. No, Michael.
Thanks, Chris. I had to interrupt your meeting. We have a situation in ZA where, because we haven't finalised the regulation of registrars, where we're quite often having a situation where hosting providers and internet service providers are registering names on behalf of their clients, and then essentially hijacking those names, holding on to those names in certain cases where
yes.
payment is argued, not argued, whether the client persists with an application. So a client does a query, makes an inquiry, seeks a quote, may not proceed with a contract, but yet suddenly the name is registered and then they're held to ransom with an argument that this is some form of hypothec, as we recognize in South African law based on the English law, similar to the hypothec that a landlord would have over a tenant's property. So if you hire an apartment and you don't pay the rent, your landlord can arrive and take your furniture. Well, they see the domain as part of the client's furniture that they can hold on to while they're waiting for payment of their rent, whether contract's concluded or not. And that's been one of the biggest issues. Other than that, we haven't really experienced much in the way of front running.
Thank you, Michael. Just because it's the longest possible distance between two people for the microphone, Nigel over here. Was there anybody else? Rolf, did you want to start? You did. Okay, so Nigel, then Rolf. Meanwhile, while that's happening, Adam, who's technical officer, has just sent me a message that says, we get complaints enough to raise suspicions, but we find it difficult to prove anything. Sometimes we get a few complaints at a time about a particular registrar, and then it stops. It's as if they only do a little bit at a time to stay off the radar. But very, very hard to show anything. Nigel.
Thank you. The word hypothec is not one that's common. I think I'm going to take that to mean lean. Is that right? Okay. I would just simply call that unlawful behaviour. Mm. The argument, if you want to take a legal argument, is that there's a constructive trust in favour of the person who should have been the registrant. But is this front running?
No.
I don't think it is.
I don't think that's front running.
I mean, we have a similar situation that happens all the time, and I think many registries do, whereby particularly web designers register in their name.
Yep.
And... Mm-hmm. We had a particular case in Guernsey with an advertising agency went into liquidation recently. And to clean that up was you know, to get the permission of the liquidators to transfer the domains to the real owners. But this isn't really front running.
No.
Front running is, if you like, getting in there a completely unrelated third party who is somehow privy to information that he shouldn't have, or if he has got it lawfully, it's subject to some kind of trust.
Okay. Thanks, Nigel. Rolf, and then we'll move on to the next section or topic.
The one thing I'll interject while the mic is being passed is, when we reached out and asked the community, I received about 300 complaints over the course of 8 or 9 weeks. And the one thing that was quite remarkable to me was that I sort of looked at the names and said, there's just so little monetization that could come from many of these names other than, coercion. And none of the parties had actually been coerced. No one, that what they had done was gone and said, I'd like to buy this because you've registered it. And maybe the party said, well, I want to keep it. Maybe I will sell it to you. But there was no overt act of, hey, I registered this domain that you clearly want for $3,000. You can have it. So it's a very, very soft subject.
Rolf?
Yeah, Rolf Meyer from .nl. I'm sure we're not getting a significant amount of complaints, otherwise I would know. I remember from the 4.5 years that I'm with SIDN, one case where we invited a registrar to give an explanation and had him transfer a domain.
Okay. All right. Well, we should move on to the next session, but I'm sure, Dave, that if anyone wants to talk to you personally, you'd be interested in...
There's one thing I would like to do is sort of a brief little promotion. One of the things that that ESAC and the ICANN staff have been studying and worrying over with the respect to who is the fact that there are so few standards that exist to help us understand how registration information other than domain name is going to be represented accepted through forms, for example, and we've released a study called Internationalizing Who Is. There will actually be a BOF that I think would be of particular interest to many of those of you in the CCNSO. And the BOF, I'm just going to skip forward, is this evening at 6:00. It's in function 4-5 on level 4. And I really do hope that some of you can come because, we would love to have more of a perspective of those of you who, may today be offering users opportunities to submit information, and you do display information in scripts other than Roman in languages and characters from local languages and scripts.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on to the next session, which is about law enforcement. And if I could ask Dave, you're staying. Rolf, you're doing a presentation on this in this section. Yeah, it says here cooperation with law enforcement agencies in the Netherlands. So if you could come and do that, Danny. If you can come up, that would be great. Michael, Silber, Rodney, if you can come, thank you. And I think that's it. Now I actually have to be elsewhere for a little while. So Byron is going to chair this session. And Rod, I apologise. I didn't realise that you were. Yeah. So, over to you, Byron. While everyone's coming up, we're going to start with Dave again. So that's handy because you're already plugged in.
Just trying to make sure I have what I need here. Is this one? This one? It? I'm trying to, this must be it. Right? No. We didn't put the fancy heading on. No, that's no problem. I think I'll just get started because I know people are going to get hungry and you may not hear me over the growling bellies. Rod Rasmussen of Internet Identity AI are going to sort of play tag team here and discuss some of what we see as the top trends in DNS security and in threats to the DNS and in abuse of DNS. So this is a perspective that's taken from more of a broader than ICANN and more of a broader than ESSAC perspective. Rod and I share time on the APWG. We are also involved together in the Registry Internet Safety Group and a number of other organizations and conferences where people meet to try to understand how to combat electronic crime. And identity theft and other misuse of the DNS. The first that I think many of you are probably well aware, since some of them, you know, some of these have occurred even during the course of an ICANN meeting, is that there have been, there has been an escalation and a constant stream of attacks against domain name registrants through registration services. And there are several forms of these attacks. In some cases, either the registrant or staff at a registrar has been socially engineered to disclose the account credentials of a domain name account. In some cases, vulnerability in a web application has been used, in particular a SQL data insertion, data insertion attack has been used to gain access to a registry database, and once the registry database was accessed, multiple high-profile domains were then taken over, and changes were made to the configuration information and the contact information in these cases. In other cases, it appears that some form of either guessing or brute force attacks have been used to gain access through a weak authentication system. In all these cases, the objectives were not only to gain access to the account, but to modify the DNS configuration once access was gained, and then to use the name service to either build a web defacement or redirect traffic to some identity theft or phishing site to essentially harm the registrant or take advantage of a service the registrant offered and commit another form of fraud or electronic crime. There are collaborated to write a report about impersonating registrars in phishing attacks, and only shortly after this was published, there were some significant attacks. Hopefully, we weren't the instigator of that. Giving people a lesson on how to attack is not my job. And the second is something called measures to protect against registration service exploitation or misuse. And this is probably going to be published sometime in mid-July. Is this one yours?
Yeah.
So this one's Rob's.
So, and one of the things that we're continuing to see, and we've seen this over the years, is that the criminals are constantly looking for new vectors into getting names into the DNS so they can use them, either directly by taking them over or by registering them. What we've also found via the studies and things that we've done are that the TLD and the domain itself are not necessarily what's important. They can use the DNS to add things like a subdomain that's got a brand in it, like eBay or Bank of America or Posta Italiana, whatever they are trying to attack, and then what they need is access to the DNS system in order to set up their infrastructure to make their attack occur. And they systematically test and move between registration services, different TLDs with different policies, different registrars with different security postures, and they are constantly probing and testing them. And what you find is that they'll use these for the types of attacks that have been under consideration here and for policy development like Fast Flux, and that the people who are using those kinds of techniques are also the ones that are most responsible for the glut of spam and other things that you hear complaints about. They are the ones that have these sophisticated infrastructures. We do have a couple of relevant documents from the APWG on this, and we continue to work with the community here, which is why we come and present to the CCNSO and various other constituencies on the latest data and trends, and try to help learn together how to fight these guys off.
This is next is a subject that you'll probably hear more of later this week. It's an issue that ESSAC has raised to the board of directors, and in particular, the concern that we have is that wildcarding, redirection, and synthesized responses should be prohibited in new GTLD offerings. To explain what we're talking about when we say redirection and synthesized responses is we're talking about returning a positive response to a DNS query when a negative response is expected. So if you recall the SiteFinder implementation in the, I guess it was the 2004 timeframe, what occurs is that either the registry or the operator who is hosting a zone on behalf of a registrant simply looks, you know, in a query, and if he can't answer the query with a name that has already been instantiated in the zone, and the response ought to be NX domain, non-existent domain, he will substitute a name and an IP address of an asset that he owns or some other landing page that could possibly be monetized or used for advertising purposes. There's another form of this that has become quite nefarious in hotels and broadband environments and any public kiosks where you offer free or for-fee internet, and it's an on-the-fly modification. And so in these cases, the TLD or a zone administrator actually has issued a non-existent domain, and somewhere along the line, there's a resolver that is providing a service to a client, and that resolver says, "Oh, I'm going to change this because I'm going to redirect, redirect this page to a page that I'm monetizing." One of the big problems about this is that a lot of the people who are in this business only cater to the web application aspect of this, and so they redirect to traffic for a website, not thinking that they can be affecting other services as well. If you redirect mail systems, you redirect voice systems, you can really seriously cause considerable operational difficulties for an organization. So a typo of something like mxx.example.com redirected to the wrong mail server could be very, very serious. The real big problem here is that the zone authority actually loses control over his delegated names, and many, many applications make certain trust assertions based on the fact that the name is in the same zone. Another problem is that there are many, many management applications and monitoring applications that simply break if they never, ever get a non-existent domain response because they don't know that the zone is actually perfectly populated with every string, and so they can't really monitor effectively. There are two documents that are relevant here. An earlier document that we wrote last year actually explained the growing error resolution market and some of the problems there, and that is SAC 32. The document that we published this week to the board is SAC 41, and it's a recommendation to prohibit use of redirection and synthesized responses as new TLDs. Obviously, this applies to the GTLD space. One of the things that I'm here for and hoping we can talk about at some point is whether or not this is the kind of activity that CCTLD operators would also agree to prohibit because of the many, many negative consequences of engaging in this activity. The third in our string here is botnets, and it's no secret that botnets have become a global pandemic. There are infections in every country. I believe Greg Rattray is going to speak with you about Conficker in some detail sometime today or tomorrow. And one of the aspects of Conficker, which was an internet worm of significant proportion, was that it abused the DNS and domain registrations in over 100 TLDs. So it did affect many, many of you, and in fact, many of you were part of the operational response in trying to contain the worm. Big problem with botnets is the problem that we've had with all malicious code for years, and that is that malware removal is extremely hard. The writers not only quickly adapt to responses or to countermeasures and detect detection by modifying the code that they have, but they also continue to escalate, you know, and change the way that they distribute their malware and conduct or support criminal activities to stay one step ahead of law enforcement and takedown measures. One very positive aspect of the Conficker working group that Greg will talk about was that we were very successful for a period of time in containing botnet activity. We certainly didn't eliminate it. That would have been a great, great win. But we discovered that the security and DNS and law enforcement communities can be proactive as well as reactive and work much more coordinated and effectively than we had before. And we hope to sustain that.
One of the issues that has come up recently, within the last couple of years, is that we are seeing more and more criminals going outside of the traditional registration process to obtain access to the DNS system. And they're going to what we call subdomain registration services, where you have a third-level label that they are registering at some private organization or not-for-profit type of setup, where they get a subdomain delegated underneath an actual delegated domain. These have been on the rise really for the last 2 years, to the point where we're seeing just about as many subdomains used as malicious registrations as there are registrations at a registrar or registry to support activities like phishing and malware distribution. There's a few examples here we have on the slide. These are actual subdomains that were used, and you can see there's a domain like pokda.ru, a very popular service in Russia, and they set up a subdomain signin.ebay underneath that. wellsfargo.ns8-wisty.fr. That's another example of a recent phishing site that was set up. These are, you take advantage of the fact that they can get full DNS services underneath a domain name. Now, it affects TLD operations, especially picked Russia and France in particular here, because there are many numbers of these subdomain services within those TLDs, and those sites get set up within domains on those TLDs, and then people looking at parsing email and other things to use preventative measures do counts and things like that based on TLDs often. So there's an effect at the third level that goes all the way up to the top level. This is a concern for operators. So getting a handle on that and knowing who those providers are within your TLD is a very good idea so that you can help hopefully have them address their security issues. Because even if you've tightened up security at the registrars that use your TLD, you don't have control necessarily over those subdomain. And they're certainly using, the methodologies they have are not just traditional web hosting. They have, you see these things being used for blogs, for picture sites, and, of course, email. And email is one of those things that people don't think about as much, but we see a lot of this activity going on for drop accounts and things like that, so that somebody who's trying to steal credentials, credit card information, et cetera, will use something like this as an email account to do this. And it really operates outside of your authority, either of any authority, really. And you have the problem of not having access to WHOIS information or the traditional tools that law enforcement and others have to track down site owners or registrants or what have you to mitigate a problem. So it really becomes an ad hoc type of process where you have to go to a single provider and hope to get a response from them in order to mitigate an issue with them. And here's some statistics on this. We had in the last half of last year, we had over 6,300 subdomains on 480 different domain names in the second level. And it's a 50% increase over the first half of the year on our latest survey. And really, of the domain names that were used for phishing attacks in the second half of last year, if you counted these subdomain services as domain names, they'd represent about 12% of the space. So it's a very significant number. And I already mentioned the abuse levels at TLDs. And there is a a couple of documents that are on the APWG website that address this specifically, one that Dave and I co-wrote a while back going directly into this issue, and then of course the survey itself, which talks about these trends. And
I just want to jump in for a minute just as a time check. Since we have a number of other panelists here, we're getting close to the time.
Okay. Well, we have the latest survey. Several of that was mailed out to the constituency, so I won't go into the details here. Other than the fact that we already mentioned, the fishers are happy to use any domain name in any place they can get it. Let's go ahead and move on. Those are some numbers. The striking one from this second half of the year was Venezuela. They had a major problem there with the registry and policies and procedures in dealing with domain names. So this metric here is how many domains per 10,000 are used for phishing, and you can see in Venezuela it was 182 per 10,000. That's a very high number. That's a record number for our survey. Thailand was the second on the list. Those were all government servers. And that's it for our part of this.
Great. Thank you very much. That was extremely interesting, an extremely interesting overview. And I'm from Canada, and I know we have some wild carding that goes on, and I find it very irritating when it happens in my own house, in my own space. Are there any questions? I mean, there was an awful lot of material brought up there. Any questions from the group? Maybe Sabine to start with, who's a number of rows back.
If it helps, we can certainly take questions after, during break.
So. Sure. I think, just given the number of presentations and the time we have allotted, probably take two or three questions, and then any others will have to go offline.
We're happy to break for lunch.
Yeah. Okay. Sabine?
Yes, Sabine Doro from .de. I have learned a lot, and I have I would just say from a registry point of view, I think a lot of things, I'm not sure if they are really associated to registries and registry policy and registry businesses. When it came to the wildcard issue, perhaps, I understand that it raises concerns if a TLD operator is redirecting the DNS, is changing DNS queries like it happened with the VeriSign SiteFinder thing. I'm not sure if it really violates stability and security. But I understand from a market perspective it might cause a lot of problems. If it came down to, let's say, single ISPs, like, let's say, access providers or hotels or doing it and making it transparent to the end customer, I have actually no problem with it. Because that's, I know the German Telecom is doing it, Hansenet is doing it, a lot of German providers are doing it. And it's basically something where they try to come back with valuable input as other providers do also, like Google. So it might violate the search engine power from some other people. But as long as I have the customer choice to disable it, and that's basically what I would ask for, I don't have a problem. So when I go to German Telecom and I know I have the option to, if a DNS doesn't resolve, they will provide me with other searchable results, and I have a choice. I think that's something where a customer can decide and where a customer can actually go for. So I don't really ask where is the problem.
So I don't want to spend a lot of time answering it other than to point out that customers don't have a choice. Maybe the registry customers have the choice, but the actual end user doesn't have the choice because somebody in the middle is actually modifying a response. And the real danger here at the lower levels is that what has happened and what has been demonstrated time and time again is that the page that you are directed to is exploitable by a script or by some attacker. And instead of getting a negative result, you actually get hijacked or you end up being infected by some malware that's been placed on the page because the page provider, and I don't want to single out Bear Fruit, but Bear Fruit is one that does this,
actually did not do as good a job securing their web page as maybe DuPont might have or Microsoft might have. So if you get redirected on a non-existent domain but, you know, that's under DuPont, you've taken the response completely out of the trust domain that DuPont's security team would have protected. And now you're vulnerable to whatever somebody else managed to, you know, to forget to do in the web application security world.
But a lot of people are doing it because they think they do something which is beneficial for the user. And a lot of users are thinking that's really beneficial. I think and that is something you might want to take into account, that from a technical perspective and for a, let's say, liberal thinking person, and I usually don't want the companies decide what's useful for me and what's not. I understand that from that perspective, you say, no, I don't want to be offered with a service I don't ask for. But from the other hand side, I see a lot of people really saying, yes, it's useful for me. And right, it's
well,
good.
They will until they're the ones that are infected or attacked. I mean, that's the real problem, is that it's just like anything else. Everybody's perfectly happy until they're the victim.
Can we?
Yes, but as so long as
let's take this.
Let's
this
take that one offline. It's a good discussion, a long debate. I can just take one more on this presentation from Nigel, which unfortunately is up here in the front, out of sight.
Thank you. 2 points. I've been picking them up as they go along. The first point is actually very interesting, what you mentioned about hotels and on-the-fly rewriting of domain name results. Forgive me, but isn't that just purely and simply interception of communications, and it's a crime?
It actually depends on... I've gotten three different interpretations of that from three different, FCC and law enforcement kinds of individuals.
Well, my interpretation is that in Europe, that's a crime.
Then go after them, please.
The other point was in relation to subdomain registries. And this is something that, as a registry in .gg, we've had to deal with despite our small size, in that we have a number of subdomain registries, private subdomain registries, perhaps because, as a small registry, we've had 2- and 3-letter domains readily available quite late in the day. And at the end of the day, from a registry perspective, we consider them as ordinary registrants, and they are responsible for all content within the context of our terms and conditions and their operations. So when we get a complaint, we look at our terms and conditions and say, is this being used for something that is illegal under European or island law? And we talk to the registrant and say, if you do not fix this, you will be in breach of our terms and conditions, and we may take action. And usually, within a very short period of time, this disappears. We've never actually had to do this.
Thanks for the comment. I'm going to keep this moving now. So we're going to go to Roloff, who's going to present on cooperation with law enforcement agencies in the Netherlands.
Everybody is already dreaming about lunch.
Yes, exactly. So if we could try to keep it under 10 minutes, I'm sure everybody would appreciate that.
I didn't want to invoke that response. So what do we do now? I think this one is F4, F7. It's not my laptop. Something happening? Right, so I've prepared an overview, Maybe just a disclaimer at the start. I focused on cooperation with law enforcement. SADN also cooperates in a more positive way with other ministries, for instance, on promoting the good use of the internet and education. It seems that within governments, this promoting the good and fighting the bad is strictly separated. So this presentation is about fighting the bad. I'll shortly present on three activities, our who is, notice and takedown, and something that would probably translate into the Safe Internet Forum, but for which, of course, we have a better Dutch name. And the first question that comes up, and I've already put it on because very often my colleagues from other registries ask me this question, why collaborate at all? Why not follow the conventional approach and just wait until somebody comes with a court order and then you just do what they tell you? We have two reasons why we have evolved to a slightly different approach. The first one is that we feel a responsibility towards the local internet community as a steward of the .nl namespace. And the second one is, well, maybe it's like a shared profit. As SIDN, we also see a possibility to better our position as a domain which is safer than most others for users. But that, of course, means that you have to be very fairly proactive in fighting certain things. Okay. Extended access to the WHOIS. The WHOIS of SIDN so far has been used as an example in the GAC discussion, for instance, on the WHOIS, as an example of a WHOIS that is very open within a very restricted data protection legislation. And I can tell you that's only a temporary affair because we, based on a public consultation, we are going to change our WHOIS. We're going to show a very limited set of data, so no personal data any longer. And that means that for law enforcement, who now has access to the who is limited, as they're not registrars, to 15 queries every 24 hours, but they get all the data. And the new WHOIS will not show any data that are very useful to them except the registrar data. So with certain law enforcement agencies like our local police, but also our telecommunications authority, and also, is that our public health authority, I think it would translate into, we've been working on contracts that would provide them with a special access to our WHOIS, not unlimited, but a larger number than the 15 queries per day, and also an extended set of data. So it will provide more data, more or less the same data that is available for a registrar on his own registered domains. It's not a very fast process, I can tell you, because we want to do this on the basis of a contract. And also we have stipulated that the particular arrangement needs approval of a data protection unit. So that's not our problem. We tell the law enforcement agencies, no, you come up with a proposal that you've already passed through the data protection unit. If they agree and we find it's proportional, then we will agree as well. So we have about three or four draft contracts and none of them has been signed so far. Then, and I have the feeling that I'm beginning to bore some of you on this subject. So I promise this is the last time. In the Netherlands, we have, in the end of 2008, oh, you're laughing about the picture, right? Yeah, I'll come to that. We formulated a code of conduct for notice and takedown. It's a result of a collaboration between the private sector, mainly the ISP and the hosting industry, and several ministries. And it aims to assure that every complaint about unlawful or criminal content is treated. So it will not just be said, no, you don't have to be here, you have to go somewhere else. No, it will be picked up and it will be processed.
And that means that in the chain it will be passed on to the proper party. And of course the first proper party will be the owner of the information or the party hosting it. It is directed only at unlawful or criminal content. So it's that's why I put in this this illustration. It's not about somebody being just too stupid to go to be on the internet or something that is unwanted. That's a discussion that very quickly comes up if you talk about illegal and or unlawful and criminal. Then very soon governments also want to regulate unwanted information, and they have very good examples of which we will all say, oh yeah, that should have been illegal. But this is on unlawful and criminal. And what we have agreed upon is that there where the complaint is treated, it's the organization itself or a third party it hires to do that. The party itself judges if this is a case of unlawful or criminal information content. And if the answer is yes, they will take it out. And it means that eventually, especially in the cases where both the registrar and the hosting party and the registrar are foreign parties, that it could happen that we as a registry will be the party that takes down the domain name. Then as a last example, very recently we created the Safe Internet Platform in the Netherlands. It's also a public-private sector collaboration. It's a small group, about 12 people, captains of industry mainly, together with people high in the government, like the Secretaries of State, of Justice and Economic Affairs. And the aim is to enhance safety and trust of the internet in the Netherlands. It's a group of people that set the national priorities and also formulate an approach. And then, of course, the work is done by another group or several groups, working groups that are directed by this platform. They have formulated a number of priorities, of which the most important ones are the implementation of the code of conduct I just spoke of, filtering and blocking of child sexual abuse content, and the fight against botnets, of which we heard just recently. That was my overview. I think I stuck to the 10 minutes, Mr.
Thank you very much. Yes, excellent job. That was very interesting. And as a registry that's very recently gone through a complete change to the who is, and in fact actually are currently in a consultation, it's a very dear subject to .ca. I'm going to limit it to two or three questions. Is there... Sorry, I don't know everybody's name, so I will have to point on occasion.
Sure. Calvin Brown. I just want to understand that correctly. So you, this process that you've implemented is tying the contents associated with a domain name to that domain name. And based on the contents of a website, for example, the domain name would be removed in your process that you've put together. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, what I try to explain is that would be the last resort, because of course there can be far much more under a domain name than just that particular bit of content. So normally in the procedure, and so far under the code of conduct, we haven't had any requests to take out the domain name. But if the owner of the information doesn't react, if the party hosting the website, for instance, doesn't react, then in the end it might come up to taking out the domain name. But that is a last resort option, and of course you have to make sure then that it's the whole website that is probably aimed at this content and not just a page with something put there by somebody else. Does that answer your question?
Hilda?
Debbie Monaghan, .nz. I suppose I'm interested in how a registry can actually, how far you can go without getting so involved in use. Basically, you're judge, jury, and executioner. and you talk about clearly criminal and clear standards, but I think if you look at some decisions that some juries make, one person's call on what might be clearly one situation somebody else doesn't agree with. So how do you set, if you like, standards or exactly what measure will be achieved for you to take down a site?
Yeah, well, of course, this is the difficult bit about it. And you hit it right on the head. And it's very difficult to set a standard. And we definitely can't. So if we are requested to take out a domain, we will only do it if there's an immediate need to do it, so that it cannot wait for a judge to come with a verdict or something. So that might be a phishing site or broad fraud or something. And it has to be very, very evident. And otherwise, if there's a doubt, we will not do it. But luckily, I think this is where the 80-20% rule also applies. 80% of the cases are very, very evident.
I have a question, Sabine Dolder again. How do you find very evident?
I think
we're
going to stick to two.
Okay,
now carry
question,
on, Sabine.
Last question, but yeah. This time you got to make it quick, okay?
I always make it quick. How do you define very evident in legal terms?
I think it's just about the same question as Debbie said. To give you an example, there was a party that was hosting a website which looked very, very much like the website of our Chamber of Commerce in the Netherlands. Same colors, same style, whatever. And it was sending bills to companies for their annual contribution. And the bills also looked very much like the bills that you get for our Chamber of Commerce. And a lot of companies were going for it. So in the end, we were asked to take down that domain name, and we did. And that was after we sought legal advice from a trusted legal party, of course. And this was an example of a very, very evident case. But I don't have a legal definition for very evident. Or maybe it should be beyond a doubt or something. But
thank you very much. We're going to have to cut it off there to keep some semblance of a schedule. Thank you very much. Next is Danny, who's going to be doing cooperation with law enforcement agencies in Sweden.
Okay, I'm going to give you a good feeling then. Mine is less than 5 minutes. When I got the question, my first reaction was, I cannot do a presentation on this because I don't have that much relationship or cooperation with law enforcement. But we thought about it, and one thing I want to start with, that 10 years ago they put .se in a foundation, and one of the reasons was to avoid becoming a police and to give too easily access to our database and to easily bring down domain names. So even though we are regulated by top-level domain law, we are very reluctant, and we are more the traditional registry, saying that normally you have to come with a court order before we do something. One of the things we had is that we had very creative police officers calling us and calling different people within the registry, asking for information about a registrant. We have a very restricted WIS. Limited information of private users are shown. So we had people calling us, and they weren't involved in criminal investigation. So what we did is we came up with a form. So they have to write down name, and that they have a mandate that they are actually involved in a criminal investigation, and that did the trick. So after that, we only had 10 requests since 2005. Just saying that yes, you can have a problem with people working in the police being too interested in data about registrants that is not related to criminal investigation. What other types of contexts that we have is mostly this type of somebody from the police calling us and say you have to shut down pedophile.se, which is an example. In a way, there's nothing wrong with the word pedophile.se. It's in the lexicon. And this was actually a good case for us to educate people about domain name and the difference between content and the domain name. And the same thing we had when our cert asked us to put a shutdown, a typo. Handelsbank, handelsbank.se, tradebank.se. There also you could have some sort of education and training on the job regarding that a bank doesn't have to mean a Swedish bank. It can be a lot of other different things. And even though we tried for the last 2 years, we still had, even this year, our regulator asking us to have a ban on every BANK domain under that SE. So we wrote them back a letter actually this month, 2 weeks ago, saying that we're not planning to do that. So let's see how that ends. That could be a longer presentation by the end of the year. I skipped this one. So conclusions from our point of view, we're actually rarely involved in law enforcement. It's not that often that we have contacts, and you shouldn't be too worried if you don't have too much contact with law enforcement either. So it's not that all the presentations here will give you an uneasy feeling that I'm missing here something. I think it's still a registry's task not to have an open door and to become police. We say we don't want to perceive that's the right arm. We want to be very reluctant, and you really have to come with proof and evidence. And we're not the one to judge the content. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny. And you're right, you kept right on time. Do we have any questions for Danny?
Can I react? You?
Any questions?
Can I react?
Yes, please.
Just as a clarification, the examples that you're given, they wouldn't work under the notice and takedown code of conduct. So those are clearly things that we wouldn't touch because, well, answering the two questions that were asked from the public, this is definitely not illegal or criminal. I think the difficulty is in finding the right balance, and we probably all struggle with it. Where do you stop behaving responsibly and become irresponsible? And that can work both ways. You can ignore certain things and be irresponsible, but you can also act too actively and become irresponsible. And that balance, I think, is very difficult to find.
It is definitely a challenge. Fortunately for us, with .ca, the questions that we've received or the inquiries we've had have been relatively straightforward. We haven't had one of those real gray ones on the margin yet, but you're absolutely right. Those are going to be the tough ones.
Sure. Just a quick question on Sweden in particular. I just looked at our numbers. We had 116 phishing attacks using .se domains last year, or the second half of last year. All 116 of them were on hacked servers. Mm-hmm. So they were not domain names registered. I know Sweden has a very restrictive policy on registering domains. The question is, the whois information is very valuable when it discloses who owns a domain name so that person or organization can be contacted to let them know that their server has been hacked into. What kind of provisions do you have for that kind of instance in dealing with issues within the Swedish system?
Are they private customers? Are they company businesses?
It looks like most of them were businesses. But
okay, but then we have open information.
Too.
Everybody can find it immediately.
And for individuals who's...
Individuals, then you have to contact us.
Right. But is that something that you assist with?
Yes, if there's a really phishing attack, then we would do it.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Danny. So with that, we're going to move to the next presentation. Michael from .za, or .za, depending where you're from, I guess, on the legal framework and e-crime cooperation initiatives in South Africa.
Thanks very much. While I do serve on the board of the .za Domain Name Authority, you'll notice that the presentation is intentionally placed on an Internet Service Providers Association or South African ISP Association template, because as a domain name authority, we've had very little interaction with law enforcement. The other issue is that South Africa works in a rather unique sub-delegated second-level system where we've inherited a situation where second levels under ZA have been assigned to various registries with a set of informal registrars acting within most of those, and generally those registrars are internet service providers in the general sense, being both access and connectivity providers as well as hosting providers. On that basis, I'll give you a little bit of background, chat a little bit about the Impact initiative, which gained quite a bit of prominence last year and seems to have died down, as many of these do. A little bit about content, people trafficking, training that we're doing, and whether this is actually bad for ISPs, and touching on this debate that's just been going on about how activist do you want to be, and as opposed to just being completely reactive. We're at the moment the largest industry association representing the internet industry in South Africa. As it so happens, there are also two officers from the ISP Association who sit on the board of .za, and one now sits on the board of ICANN. We represent the largest group of registrars. We also have three registries as members, simply because of the connectivity benefits that membership gives you, as well as the ability to use internet exchange points, where we operate a private internet exchange point, which is limited to our membership. We allow members to self-categorize and choose their own category of membership. We also have honorary members, including a fair number of the educational institutions. Our biggest exclusion is a company called Telkom South Africa, the previously wholly government-owned, previously incumbent monopoly telco, which for historical reasons won't join us, largely because we've taken them on consistently around their claim that internet service and internet access was a monopoly service that only they were entitled to provide in South Africa. We took them on and succeeded both in front of the telecoms regulator as well as in court on a number of occasions. So they're a little bit miffed about our successes over the years and won't join us. We've now been recognized as an industry representative body in terms of our e-commerce legislation, which only took 6 years and 10 months. And we're the only entity that's ever actually applied for recognition as an industry representative body, which means we have a code of conduct, sorry about the spelling error, which requires notice and takedown process. In our view, the notice and takedown only applies to hosted content. Our view is that it doesn't apply to domains registered by any of our members acting as a registrar. It also doesn't apply to any of our members who act as a registry in taking domain registrations. In addition, it should be noted that the notice and takedown process is an entirely voluntary process, and our members, in choosing to accept and accord with the notice and takedown process, then create a complete exemption from liability. But if they choose to refuse, then they may be liable for their ongoing hosting of that content, and that's really designed to prevent abuse. So I'm hosting a large bank, and somebody... a very irate customer sends a takedown notice alleging unlawful content on the bank servers, and I take it down, thereby causing significant financial harm. I most likely would refuse to take down that content, certainly without at least validating it for myself, as compared to an individual customer where I may be willing just to take the content down, and because I have an exemption from liability, accept the consequences. ISPA has also been involved in participation in Impact. We received a government invitation passed down through from the Impact Secretariat based in Malaysia. I'll describe in a second what impact is. The South African government invited us to join the delegation attending the impact summit and the impact formation. The South African government is looking to establish a CERT, which is not yet operational, and they're looking towards our cooperation in terms of establishing and participating within that CERT. On that basis, we attended with them the Impact Summit, being very impressed by the initial board of directors, including Vince Cerf, as one of the initial directors of Impact, essentially an international multilateral partnership against cyber terrorism, built on a number of dynamic pillars focused on specific functions, being as creating a center for global response, a center for policy and international cooperation, a center for training and skills development, and a center for security assurance and research. Their view is the increasing amount of abuse on the internet, creating the possibility of a consolidation of unlawful activities and potentially harmful activities on the internet leading to a situation of cyber terrorism. My personal view, having attended the summit, having done some reading, is this notion of a cyber terrorism is a fanciful way of government agencies obtaining additional funding. I think everybody who's been involved in security in some form or another, physical, logical, or otherwise, knows the easiest way to increase your budget is to claim a significant threat that needs to be addressed. That doesn't mean the threats aren't there. I just think that this notion of organized cyber terrorism is being rattled by security agencies to get additional budget and additional powers within local countries. What we have been doing very significantly within South Africa is working around issues of people trafficking. There's a task team that's been created dealing with child pornography, and I agree. I prefer Roloff's reference to images of child sexual abuse, as well as trafficking of women and children and related issues. This, unfortunately, also includes, and the task team has gotten very confused by the inclusion of prostitution, because South Africa still has a situation where, theoretically, adult prostitution is unlawful and criminalizes both the use of prostitutes as well as the profession of prostitution, and that has created and sidetracked this task team to the extent where they spend more of their time debating whether they should be going and prosecuting prostitutes instead of actually focusing on the real point, which is images of child sexual abuse and trafficking. We have decided to be as neutral as possible, not get involved in the debates as to what they're doing, but rather get involved in training in terms of what is the internet, how to find information on the internet, trying to explain to people, for example, what who is, so that they can use the who is that is available within South Africa, as well as to be able to get preliminary information outside of South Africa using who is, rather than feeling they need to take the large, blunt instrument of law enforcement and go and issue warrants to get information that may very well be publicly accessible. We've been doing a fair amount of work with our local agency, the Fulman Publications Board, who are responsible for, in some cases, pre-approval of films and generally pre-approval of films, post-publication verification of publications. They're also responsible for enforcement around images of child sexual abuse. They have now become a member of InHope, the international organization of child abuse hotlines. We've been assisting in terms of that process. We were very involved with training and awareness within the, our Film and Publications Board. We respond when a request was sent out to Uniforum, who run our largest second-level domain, COZA, to please hand over a copy of their database. We actually met with the board to explain to them that by using Whois, you're able to access information, and there actually isn't a need to hand over a static version of the database in a format yet to be decided, which is largely irrelevant and pretty much useless. But there was a feeling that they needed it. When we also explained that simply because a domain is registered in South Africa, we don't have, certainly within our open second levels, we don't have a locality requirement, that it doesn't mean because a domain is registered in ZA, that it's a South African domain. Similarly, the fact that a domain is registered outside of South Africa doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a South African who's participating. So we've been building a lot of awareness. There's a lot of ignorance in terms of basic principles of how the internet actually works. What's very important, though, and based on advice received from a number of colleagues around the world, is that we're in the process of putting a protocol in place with our Film and Publications Board, as well as with various of the law enforcement and prosecution agencies, dealing with the process of handing over evidence of child sexual abuse images, so that we have a clear understanding which we can pass through to our members, explaining to them what to do if they receive a takedown and they investigate and it turns out that there are images of child sexual abuse. How do they retain evidence? How do they hand over evidence? How do they report the existence of a possible offense without getting involved and potentially prosecuted for actually looking at the images in an attempt to verify whether they are abusive or not? We're performing very similar training and awareness raising with our South African Police Service. At the same time, I have to confess that we're having major problems getting the police to investigate what they consider to be victimless internet crime. So things like theft of ADSL logon details, we've had some significant difficulty getting the police to investigate. And without police investigating and without police warrants, we struggle then to get identity details of the person or persons who are actually hacking ADSL accounts. We have a problem prosecuting spam, even though we have a relatively weak anti-spam law, actually trying to get police and the prosecutor to investigate and actually prosecute. Clear instances of spamming has proved almost impossible, but we're trying to build those relationships. That being said, we take the view that we need to cooperate and we need to try and influence law. We need to try and work with law enforcement agencies, because otherwise we're going to land up with blunt and sometimes rather stupid approaches to law enforcement.
And that concludes.
That's it.
Thank you very much.
Let me hand over to Rodney. Maybe we should rather take questions after Rodney's presented, and that way consolidate and save a bit of time.
I think that's a good idea, although I will say it seems like you take a very proactive educational stance, very, very proactive. So with that, Rodney.
So let me go ahead and get this set up. So slightly different tact over here. Not going to particularly talk about law enforcement per se on its own, but more about why it's important that you actually look at dealing with law enforcement a little differently. So how about this? That's a copy of a chat in one of the underground IRC channels. I have anonymized it slightly because I wanted to protect the guilty. But this goes on all the time. The bad guys know who does what and they know where they can hide. So what you're looking at here is some intercepted chat from some of the underground channels that we have that talks about the fact that it's not worth going to some TLDs, and others are great for bulletproof hosting and bulletproof domains. And if your name is in there, you're going to be paying money, and I'll explain to you why that occurs. Let's have a look here at why we got involved in dealing with this as a company in 2006. We didn't want to be that TLD that was picked on by the bad guys. We wanted to stop abuse of our internal infrastructure, and we didn't want to give the bad guys the ability to use our TLD to organize their battles against others on the internet. I talked yesterday, I think it was, about some of the effects of Conficker and the use of the DNS. We didn't want to be part of that underground criminal process. We had the technical and the legal expertise to actually deal with it. Some of the registries out here may not. And what we wanted to do was to look at what we could change within our process, as well as with our registry agreements and our agreements with registrars, so that when we found something malicious or inappropriate, we could actually take action. One of the first things we did was, and this is talking about .biz, but you know, forget that it's a GTLD. We also operate .us, slightly different, and it'll be different for each of you. But what we did was we actually modified, during our renewal, the .biz registry. ICANN worked with us and understood the impact. And what it did effectively was gave us as the registry, despite the fact that our relationship is with the registry and not the with the registrar and not the registrant, gave us the ability, if a registrar refused to take action in an area that we felt we had sufficient evidence to identify the fact that there was malicious conduct of a certain kind, that we had the ability to suspend the domain despite the inactivity of the registrar. It's important to note over here that we weren't getting involved in the areas of IP, of intellectual property infringement or content. It was just the use of the domain in a malicious way, which could be, for example, being used as a download site, for as a download dropper for malware. It could be used as a collection point or an interaction point for malicious discussion or development of software. Believe it or not, the bad guys use the systems that you have in order to get together and develop malicious software, distribute it, and use it. When, for example, keystrokes are logged and accounts are compromised, that information is very often transferred back to the bot holder behind it over web connections to a website where he can then anonymously go ahead and retrieve it. If domains are being used in that way, obviously we have to do something about it. And unfortunately, you know, who is a whole different discussion. I'm not going to deal with that. That'll go on, you know, elsewhere this week. But when it becomes very difficult to identify that kind of who's behind something, it's difficult to also contact a legitimate domain holder and tell them that there's a problem. We would hope that the registrar would take that action for us. However, there are some registrars who don't see this as their responsibility, and the end result is that the miscreants identify which registrars are good to work with, and where you saw .zzz as a domain, as a TLD that's good for the bad guys, they also identify the registrars that are good for bad guys. You know, bulletproof domain registrations. These guys don't respond to complaints. It happens, and it's an issue. So the process for us is we get a complaint, or we have proactive detection. We have a group of people who spend their time, you know, looking at malicious domains and malicious activity that involves our TLD. We'll then go through an investigation process that's formal. In that process, there is certain documentation that's needed. The data is analyzed. It's submitted to an internal process. And once that process is accepted, we either get involved with law enforcement, so we'll identify law enforcement, we'll identify a cert if it's something that relates to some form of widespread attack that is going to affect more than us. And what we also do is we inform the registrar, and we give the registrar as much detail as we feel we can trust the registrar to deal with. I'm just as a piece of realism over here, there are some registrars that exist for no other reason than to register domains for criminal enterprises. Certainly in the GTLD world. And so in some cases, we don't provide that much information because there are times when that information has been fed back to the miscreants so that they understand how we found them and what we found, and they don't make that same mistake again. We're not in the educational process, in the educational business for miscreants. Once it's verified, we'll send it to the registrar. We'll give them 12 hours to take the domain name down. If there's been no response, if the registrar just doesn't respond at all, if the registrar responds and says, we're looking at it, but actually doesn't seem to do anything, we start an internal 12-hour clock. Our help desk, after 12 hours, will send a notification to the registrar that we're taking action, and we then go ahead and suspend the domain. Many times these days, the domains themselves, the action is taken by the registrar. They've learned, or they understand that the evidence we have is compelling and complete. You have to have a track record. So what kind of track record do we have? In fact, it's not thousands. We've actually had close to 100,000 domains in .biz that we have suspended since 2006. In all of that time, there has not been a single complaint from a registrant or a registrar that we took down a domain name inappropriately. So we look at our track record, and based on that, the company makes a decision that we're going to continue to do this. However, you have to be dead accurate in identifying the fact there's an issue. We get a lot of feedback from law enforcement. We will ask law enforcement to validate some of the results that we see. If we look at something and we're not sure that it's an issue, we'll ask them. When it comes to issues, for example, of child pornography, we don't investigate that directly. We pass it on to one of a couple of organizations that are related to law enforcement in the United States. They will do the examination. They will come back and give us the determination. We don't ask our employees to break the law either. Some of the things that you have to do in terms of taking action. We're very involved in security forums. So, for example, Rod and I know each other from probably four or five, you know, super secret campfires that we drag our chairs over to every few minutes as we get involved with different groups. We're involved in the ESSAC. We're involved in FIRST. We're involved in the anti-phishing working group. I suggest that, you know, as registry operators, you do the same thing. You will learn a lot and get a lot of additional assistance. Your law enforcement organizations probably are involved in them as well. We probably have direct links to law enforcement in maybe 40 or 50 countries as a result of what we do. Law enforcement are reasonably intelligent. You know, you may, you know, you refer to the policeman that you deal with who may be trying to get something done on the side. There are a lot of good law enforcement folks who actually are first and foremost geeks, and secondly, they're involved in law enforcement, so they don't get fooled. If you're lucky enough to know some of those, they're the ones that will work with you to help you make a decision as to whether something you should take action or not. Where does the sheriff come into it? Well, respond promptly to law enforcement questions. If you're asked something, respond promptly, even if it's a matter of saying, I can't give you the answer. Don't spend hours or days trying to decide how you want to react, because unfortunately, real things do occur, crimes occur, and in cyberspace, they occur in a matter of minutes. The damage is done. When the damage is done, it's too late. It doesn't matter what you do. When it comes to things like account compromises, when funds are transferred out, if you look at something like Torpig, which is a botnet that's been around for about 4 years now, thousands of accounts a day are cleared out of anywhere between $200 to $1,000 and moved to other countries where you can never recover the money. And it happens very rapidly. If law enforcement asks you a question, try and respond quickly so they know what to do next. Only claim privilege when it's real. Don't make the excuse of, we need a court order, if you don't really need a court order but you don't want to look like a bad guy in the community. That's inappropriate. Remember, money is at stake, and sometimes people's lives are at stake as well. If you want specific cases, I'm happy to discuss them with you one-on-one, but there are lives at stake sometimes with some of the things that occur. Notwithstanding Alan's comments about some of the cyber terrorism claims that occur, there is some of that kind of stuff does occur, and people's lives are at risk. So don't say that it requires a court order if it doesn't really. Privacy in terms of service, I have one more. Privacy in terms of service are not necessarily in opposition. You can deal with both. Try and find ways of doing it. Respond to complaints from law enforcement. If they tell you there's an issue, at least look at it and see if it's blatant. And have a very clear and public policy so that people know that what you're going to do is respond to law enforcement requests that are appropriate. So what can you hope to gain? Here's a little bit more chat from the underground. You know, C got busted. You know, why? Because the fool, you know, expletive, scanned with a particular domain. And the TLD dropped a dime on him to the feds, and he was arrested. Basically, I prefer .AAA or .BBB. Bulletproof, don't go to .ZZZ. You want to be .ZZZ. If you're AAA and BBB, a couple of things are going to happen. So if you have a problem, the sheriff rides in. If you're actually helping law enforcement, the bad guys will go elsewhere. If you have a habit of taking down domains, we have firsthand experience. If you take action, they'll go to other TLDs where they don't take action. Networks won't block your domains. You won't have the issues of people saying there's nothing good that comes out of dot whatever it is. You may as well filter. Spam Assassin won't have a permanent filter. Your complaint numbers will drop, so you'll have to do less work. If you don't support bad things, you won't get complaints. Legitimate users will prefer to use your TLD because they know that they don't get associated indirectly with criminals. And finally, more dollars to you. You'll save money and you'll make more money.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That was very interesting, both the last presentations. Just before lunch, do we have any questions for the last two presenters? Can I just ask, the timing, you noted 12 hours, but from complaint to action, should there be one, is that whole thing a 12-hour window, or is that just part of it?
No, it's part of it. Sometimes it takes us hours to actually investigate. Other times it's a couple of minutes. So it's from the moment that the investigative team has sufficient evidence that we'll take action, we give a 12-hour warning.
Okay. Any questions from the audience? Well, I just want to say thank you to the panel. I think that was an incredible amount of information. Yes. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of one-on-one dialogue now, given all the information presented. I'm now going to give a bit of a plug to the sponsor for lunch, for our lunch today, which is Afilias. Gabby's going to have 100 tickets to the lunch, and it's first come, first serve. She wanted to. And the lunch is going to be held at the Zeta Bar, which is, contrary to what's been published, it is on this level. So it's at the Zeta Bar. And I believe our sponsor may say a word.
I'm not
sponsored.
He's over there somewhere.
Aphilius? Somewhere?
He's coming.
Yeah. All right.
Do you want us to go? Should we go? Tell me if you didn't get it.
I learned as a kid, like you, respect to
me. Just before we do that, I am going to give a little plug. On Thursday afternoon, there's a DNS law enforcement-related session as well. So that would also, I think, be a very interesting one to participate in.
They're almost designed when you pull them out. So your fingers are touching. You warn the registrar.
Probably that one right there.
Oh, no. We
Danny.
Just, oh, yeah, no. We warn them. We're going to spend the domain.
Sorry. Plug in.
Four of them now in the nation states.
Thank you, Byron. Appreciate it. My name is Roland LaPlante. I'm with Afilias. I'm the vice president of marketing there. And I've talked with this group many times. Great to be back, and it's great to be sponsoring your lunch once again. I came today because I have a little bit of news on some changes at Afilias, and I wanted to just spend like 5 minutes updating you on it. So I want to talk a little bit about market trends and then some DNS capabilities that we have. The total market for domain names is large and growing. I think we all know this. There are about 180 million registrations now through the end of March. And it's an extremely competitive market. You can see this is continuing to grow, even despite the softening in the world's economies. But the rate of growth has been slowing ever since mid-2007. Industry growth peaked at about 33% back then. And in March by itself, growth in a number of domains under management was about 11% versus year ago. So a lot of industries these days would die for 11% growth. But we look at this and say, oh, my God, you know, things are going in the toilet because we're growing only a third of what we used to grow. I don't know when this is going to level out. I do not expect it to get negative ever because of the underlying growth and dynamic in the Internet itself. But certainly things are a little more difficult than they were even 6 months ago. By market share, you know, Comm continues to lead. But what I thought was interesting for this group is that the ccTLD segment, all the ccTLDs that are tracked at Zooknik have been growing for quite some time now. And if this trend continues, CCs will, as a group, will be larger than .com in the not-too-distant future. And the lower green line is all of the gTLDs except .com, and those have been pretty flat now for, gosh, the last 3 or 4 years or so. And I know there's a lot of talk in the industry about new TLDs, and one of the indications of the success of the new TLDs that may come is to look back at what have new TLDs done in the past. We've introduced a bunch of new TLDs, Info, Biz, Mobi, Asia, ME has been introduced, EU, CAT, and when you look at the sum total of all of those, which have a wide variety of business models, a wide variety of initial investment, quite a number of different approaches to the market, we see that these as a group have never been above 7% of the total market. It is extremely difficult, and we're talking with a number of potential clients for new TLDs, and one of the cautions we provide them is, if you're looking for a TLD and your business plan calls for 50 million domains, that's highly unlikely to happen. So you really need to take a close look at this. I thought this was kind of sobering, actually. Afilias itself now supports 15 TLDs. We have these five gTLDs and the 10 ccTLDs that you see here. We're doing the back-end support for all of these. We're not the domain authority for anything except .info. And there are about 14 million registrations that are running through our systems now. But the news I wanted to chat with you about a little bit is typically I come before this group and I say, let me help you with your registry. And I get a few queries, but most of you are pretty happy with the registry systems that you have now. But I have not yet come before you and said, can I help you with just the DNS piece? And starting in February of this year, we rolled out our own proprietary DNS system. And this is now available to help. It's 100% reliable. It's been running for quite a while now with 100% reliability. It's guaranteed to be 100% reliable. It's a state-of-the-art, globally distributed system that's owned and operated by Afilias. It incorporates secondary vendors, and it's architected to avoid single points of failure. We can operate as a primary DNS provider for you or a secondary DNS provider to you, depending on what kind of help you might need. And it's priced very competitively. This is a map that shows the current node structure and the distribution of nodes for our DNS system. As you can see, we have representation almost everywhere, and this delivers instant real-time updating across the world. So we have a reliability 100% uptime guarantee, which is based on diversity. It's a multi-layered, multi-tiered design with multiple hardware, software, firmware, blah, blah, blah. Additional secondary external DNS support links into this. We have high-capacity bandwidth at all of our locations. And, of course, we have 24/7 customer service and support. It's a very secure system, and the security is based on diversity. We run current bind in every location, NSD, Anycast. We've got 18 locations. We run Cisco and Juniper routers. We have multiple firewall and load balancer providers, 3 network monitoring tools. We try to have multiple everything to avoid any problem with security. We have advanced DDoS protection and mitigation. It is a DNSSEC-capable platform. Many of you are familiar with with the signing of the .org domain this month with DNSSEC. Filius is the provider for PIR to support .org, so we were we did that with them. We have high-capacity bandwidth, and we're linked to a lot of the international security experts, the guys that Rod talked about, anti-phishing working group, the SAC, and so forth. We also have a DNS management portal, which many providers don't offer. It's a web-based interface. There's a very elaborate reporting suite with advanced real-time reports that will give you traffic analysis graphically. There are standard daily, weekly, monthly views, and you can configure this to see almost anything you want that's happening in your DNS if you want to track that. And there are also enhanced security and alert services. You can log into this system, but it's highly secure. We do permissioned access with all the registrars around the world for our various domains, and this is based similarly to that. So there's access control by IP location. So how can we help you? We now have a new way to do that, offering secondary DNS services. We can offer you primary DNS services with competitive pricing that's based upon query count. So if you'd like us to take a look at what it might cost you to have us provide a secondary or primary service, send me your query counts, and we can put together an estimate. And, of course, we continue to offer complete registry services, including the DNS. We'll also be able to support your fast-track ITLDs if you're looking for a platform that can handle the IDN components. So thank you very much. Look forward to hosting lunch, and thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much, and that concludes this morning. See you at lunch.